Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all. Especially good to see live human beings in the hall. Not that our little screens aren't a form of connection. It's nice to see us in three dimension. Actually, I believe was it last weekend we did the walk? Yeah, so last weekend we had kind of a mindful gathering in Lettuce Lake Park here in Tampa. There were some 40 people there. And while I think everyone enjoyed the capacity to be outside and walk in nature mindfully, my sense is the real joy of people was just seeing each other and being able to talk to each other, you know, masked and socially distant. But I think, again, as you all know, while there are some, you know, and anyhow, we know one of the difficulties of this endless pandemic sort of semi-quarantine is our inability to really be close to each other and see each other and interact with each other as we, you know, as human beings always do. So, but this is what's going on. So we have to accept it and work with it. But as the opening verse just said now, we are here, and no matter what's going on, we always have the capacity to generate peace. So please take a moment just to check your mind and to make sure that in this moment you are at peace. You know, there's nothing disturbing you. That you're calm, you're at ease, and you're open. Again, this is the great gift of the practice, that whatever is going on in the external world, that we cannot often control or even have much effect on, and we always have the capacity within ourselves to cultivate calmness and peacefulness and openness. This is the great gift of the practice. So this weekend, I'm involved with what we call our Dharma Transmission Group. And for those, maybe some of you who aren't aware exactly what that is, and this is our second group. So there is a group in our community who have made the commitment for 3 years to study and practice the Dharma in a very systematic way. And they make a commitment to many things, but one of them is that, you know, 2 hours every day of study and practice, which is, since they're all lay people and many of them have family and work and stuff like that, that's a significant commitment. But they have done it, and they are actually our second group. We are in the second year with this group, and we, the prior group must have ended 2 years ago. And they went for 3 years. And the inspiration for that group was that I realized two things. One thing is that the group of us who had really supported and founded the community and really supported the community and all its programs, we were prone to sickness, old age, and death, like everything else in life. I wanted to make sure that there were people coming up who were who had that same grounding in Dharma. And that also I wanted to be able to present it in a very systematic way. There's a lot we offer in our community through all our retreats, our intensives, our classes, but this was a systematic presentation. So the first group went through, I think we had, you know, 14 or 15 people in it, and many of them are our current crop of leaders in our community. You know, Maria Teresa is sitting here, and Angie, and David, and Bill, and really most of the people on our leadership council, Tammy, who is head of the board, chairperson of the board, and many others were all in that first group. So it's wonderful that they have continued, to offer a service, and that they not only have great competencies and ability in a kind of a worldly way in terms of their skills and everything to offer to your community, but they're also very committed practitioners. So again, another thing that the group does is meets four times a year for weekend retreats. This is the final one for this year. And I believe many of you know that there is a text called The Way of the Bodhisattva by the 8th century Indian master Shantideva. That is really one of the most glorious and most profound and comprehensive texts within Buddhism. It's all in verse. And it really sets out the whole Mahayana path, the six paramitas, really the path of practice and realization. But with this emphasis on, that the heart of it is this desire to be awake, to be free of suffering in order to benefit all beings. It is a path that goes beyond individual liberation, where most people begin. They want to end their own suffering, or they want to have their own personal benefit through practice. Bodhisattvas vow and to make the commitment that they want to liberate all beings from their suffering. And the practice is not just about oneself. So it really means that this altruistic intention is part of the whole practice. So obviously connecting to beings compassionate, lovingly, is very much the path of practice, as well as the path of meditation and understanding. And again, the Bodhisattva is not a different kind of animal than I think many of us are used to, because we're used to social betterment, human betterment, in a societal way, very much. And so when we look to end human beings suffering, we usually see it in terms of social conditions, such as giving everyone adequate food, adequate shelter, adequate medical care, all those good things, without it make human beings' life very difficult. But the Bodhisattva really goes beyond that. It includes all that, but it really understands at a deeper level that all beings, the rich and the poor, the perpetrators and the victims, all suffer in this life. And even though the conditions may be different, and we know that as social conditions improve, people's happiness does not necessarily improve. In America, we know our own culture is certainly proof of that. Because if it really was true, by bettering social conditions, you create a better human being, then therefore one would expect in this society where, most people, not everyone, of course, have adequate food and have adequate shelter and have some of the very good, but access to healthcare, you think everybody would be happy and free of suffering. But that is not the case, is it? At all. Suffering is pervasive in this world. Fears, angers, depressions, addictions, unhappiness in relationships, and people don't want that. People want the good. And yet, why don't they get it? And so the Bodhisattva, based on the Buddhist understanding of what is the source of human being suffering, their emphasis in what they offer the world is a path out of suffering that transcends social conditions and is available to everyone. And it looks very deeply at why, what is the cause of suffering? You know, what is the cause of suffering? What is the cause of greed and anger and indifference, and, you know, hatred, intolerance, fear, anger, despair? You know, what is the root of all that? So anyhow, so this is the this is not my emphasis today. So this is the Bodhisattva path, and this is we have an intensive in Shanti David dealing with that, and this Dharma transmission group has been focusing on that. And this was a lot of the focus this weekend on the meditative concentration chapter and on the wisdom chapter. But I think those of you who know about our last retreat on getting unstuck and maybe heard my talk on the last day of retreat several weeks ago know that I have been particularly concerned that what is it about us Americans as practitioners that we have such a hard time following through on the teachings and the practices. The teachings and the practices are very simple and direct and you know, extremely beneficial to anybody who you know, undertakes their practice. And yet so many of us have such difficulty in implementing them in our lives. We continue to struggle, we continue to go back and forth. And so, you know, I've been very interested in gathering information from our community leaders and mentors, you know, about what are all the topics that people bring to their mentorships, to their mentoring groups, to their individual mentoring. What are the problems that people are dealing with that are really getting in the way of their ability to practice and implement the teachings, which are so effective? And of course, I realized not to really attend to those obstacles and hindrances and just continuing to teach the Dharma is really not helpful if people aren't really able to implement it, live it, and therefore reap the fruits of it. If anything, it can make people frustrated. So that is why, you know, we instituted that retreat on getting unstuck, which really dealt with a lot of these issues. And again, sort of what I'm interested in. So in Shantideva, so this is a, that was all by way of introduction. So this is a little different. So in Shantideva, there's a chapter called Diligence. It really precedes the chapters on meditation and wisdom, and sort of are is the I mean, since it's you know, there are eight chapters and they all build on each other, it is the segue into the meditative path. But it says we need something, we need diligence. And again, and many of you have probably heard this, Shantideva implies diligence as an aptitude for the good, for the virtuous. That's what we're being diligent in. That's what we're making effort in. That's what we're energized to do. You know, we are really very aware that we want to walk a different way in this life. We want to leave behind negativity and affliction. And negativity and affliction is all has to do with, you know, in the actions of our body, in the actions of our speech, and most importantly, in the actions of our mind. The outer two are more obvious. You know, unwholesome actions, unwholesome speech, negative actions, negative speech, much obvious because they can be seen, but less obvious and seen is the mind. And it is often in the mind that the energy that then comes out in speech or then comes out in bodily actions is being nurtured. And so it's often in our minds that we really run into the biggest hindrances, because there is our negativity, there is our affliction, there is our issues, there is our stuff. There's the stuff that is just always calling us and we're involved in. And then it therefore prevents us for taking the steps, you know, that we want in life, which is this, you know, we want all, you know, everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be wholesome. You know, if, you know, rationally we say that. Yeah, everybody wants to be free of suffering. You know, it would be a very disturbed person who says, no, I want to continue suffering. We want to be free of suffering. And yet somehow the energy and the effort and the diligence of application to achieve that is often a struggle for us. And so rather than, you know, to me, it's, you know, we need to understand that and deal directly with these hindrances, these places of repetition, internal repetition, you know. And there are many practitioners who've been at this for decades, and still we have the mind of negativity, right? Still we have doubt. Still we have hesitation. Still we have egocentricity, right? You know, there, and that's, you know, why is that? Since we talk a good game, right? We talk altruism. We talk love. We talk compassion. And often we do actions and speak that way. But often in our mind, that is not the content of our minds. And you know, Buddhism really, of the three, body, speech, and mind, puts most emphasis on the mind. Because, of course, the mind is the king, the mind is the queen, the mind is the ruler, you know. And truly, in the same way, in a feudal system, everybody's taking their orders from the king and the queen, in the same way, the actions of our body and the actions of our speech are taking their commands from our mind. So, you know, unless we always want to be struggling, and many people, their life is a struggle. Different parts of their mind telling them to do this and that. You know, we ultimately, we'd like to resolve this so we can just, you know, move speedily along the path, not because we're good Buddhists, but because we want to be happy. We want to be free. We want to bring benefit to other people in a real way, in a deep way. And so to do that, you know, this undertaking of our own healing and transformation and awakening is essential. Because then it's not just intellectual, it's not just conceptual, it's not just an idea, but we know ourselves, one, that it can be accomplished, and two, we've accomplished it, so we know the path. So therefore, when we talk and speak and teach others, we have greater capacity. And when I say that, I don't just mean that we're showing up in the world as a great Dharma teacher. I mean, even in our lives, with our families, with our friends, we are showing up in a very wholesome, stable way that really helps them to see there is another way to be in this life. And we know the Buddha said that. He said, I teach another way. I do not teach the worldly way. Because that's what he left. He had the worldly way. He had the way of success. And he found that at the deepest level, it was all fundamentally meaningless. It didn't have deep meaning. It was fundamentally a futile endeavor, because it doesn't matter how much we can grab onto in this life. Impermanence wipes it all out. It's all unstable. It's all impermanent. And at the end, we have to die, and everybody in it. I mean, and that's just the way it is. So to find a way of being in this world and create great meaning and stability and goodness that we can share to others. And again, you know, the world needs it more and more every day. We see the need for awakened people, You know, if this society put as much energy into awakening themselves and really benefiting others that we put into all kinds of other efforts, which fundamentally produce very little results. Because in the world, things are just endlessly changing. Nothing is stable. And so this is very important. Anyhow. So Shantideva identifies for all of us that the, he calls diligence is defined as a state of mind that takes joy in virtue. And then he says, well, what gets in the way of our diligence? And he identifies laziness. But his laziness is not often what we usually would call laziness. He says there are three kinds of laziness. The first is the laziness that yearns for idleness. So it's not just like couch potato. It's not just like sleeping all day, right? I mean, that's sloth. I mean, that's lazy. But he says, you know, we just take the easy path. We idleness. We do things. Idleness means we can be doing something, but it fundamentally doesn't produce any good at all. We're just being idle. It's like being in our car, you know, with the engine on, but it's idling. It's not going anywhere. And that's how a lot of us spend our time, especially our so-called free time when we're not working. We're just kind of idle. You know, we're cruising this, we're looking at this, we're watching that. You know, we're like just in terms of our life and the movement of our life, we're just idling. And he called that being lazy. Because he says, you know, where's your energy to bring benefit to others? Where's your energy for healing and transformation? We say you want this. Well, now you got some time to really be doing something about this, and yet we're idling. And he says another kind of laziness is an inclination to unwholesome actions. So, I mean, idling is sort of just kind of, you know, just running our engine but not accomplishing much. But the laziness of going to unwholesome actions, he says, so here we are, we have set a path for ourselves of wholesomeness and virtue and goodness and benefiting, and yet we often do activities which are fundamentally unwholesome for that. And unwholesome is not like generically unwholesome. Unwholesome is always in relationship to what we consider wholesome. So we have to have criteria. Each of us has to have a criteria in our life. You know, what is wholesome? And then anything, other activity that is not wholesome, therefore is unwholesome, because it's not contributing to my wholesomeness in life. Is that clear? So he calls that laziness. Laziness, we're just kind of slacking off. And then the third kind of laziness, which is really interesting, he called this self-depreciation and defeatism. Something that most of us would never consider laziness, right? We would never think of that way. But he says, yeah, we're being lazy. It's like, because the Buddhas, the masters have all said, yeah, everyone has the Buddha nature. Everyone has the potential to realize it. This path is not that difficult. I mean, no more difficult than the other difficulties. You know, look at what everybody goes through, right? Talking this morning, somebody in the group was talking about, kind of going for the touchdown. It was something about Shantideva was saying. And I thought about that. Isn't that correct? You know, if you ever watch football, you know, they're going for a touchdown, you know, and people are trying to trip them up, and people are grabbing at them, and people are, you know, knocking them, and they just what? They just keep going, right? You know, and even when they get knocked down, and tell you, you know, and when you get knocked down in football, you get knocked down, right? They get up again, you know, and then they line up for the next play. And I thought, wow, you know, and this is not just, you know, football players who make millions of dollars. You know, this is college football. This is high school football, right? You know, look what people go through. To what? To advance a ball a few yards, right? I mean, look at all people will endure. I mean, we've all endured all kinds of difficulties in life to get what we want, right? And yet, we are lazy. And so he says to doubt the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas telling us that we all have this Buddha nature, to doubt that we have the capacity and to depreciate ourselves in any way is being lazy. We're not owning up to our possibility. We're not owning up to our potential, which is there. So laziness, three kinds of laziness. But then later on, and this is what I want to talk about today, he talks about the four, you know, so like what will support our diligence? And again, it doesn't mean that maybe many of you on the call, you know, and that you're not, you're not fully into the Bodhisattva path. It doesn't matter. Wherever you are, wherever you are, whatever your own path means to you, that's what we're talking about here. And he says, it is through the four forces of aspiration, self-confidence or steadfastness, joyfulness and relinquishment, that we're able to discard the three kinds of laziness and enhance our diligence. These four forces must be in turn supplemented by two kinds of strength: earnest implementation of the principle of adopting and rejecting, and second, control of one's body and mind. So he's giving us a template, a checklist that we can utilize. And again, we talk a lot in our community. So he's talking about forces. He called it, the translator translates four forces. Forces is something that has energy, that is energized, that has power. And of course, and we do talk a lot about in the community, but we need to say it over and over again because we forget. He says the first is aspiration, which he defines as a keen interest in Dharma. Now, again, Dharma doesn't have to necessarily, obviously Shantideva was a teacher of Dharma, the Buddha's teaching. So, but it can mean whatever your Dharma is, that you have a keen interest in it. It's not just a hobby, you know? It's not just a hobby. You really are interested in this. You're interested in your transformation. You're interested in achieving your spiritual goals. And so therefore you're interested in all the teachings and practices that will get you there. It's an interest in you. It's like if you wanted to be a cook, you know, you would have a keen interest in learning how to cook, and you'd get cookbooks and you'd be watching cooking shows and you'd be, you know, people do all these things, right? I mean, they're even on TV. I don't know if there still are. They used to be Shopping Channel. You know, these are for people who have a keen interest in shopping, right? I mean, and look, there's a whole channel for them. You know, you can do it all the day. So they're probably very good at it. Very good at their shopping, getting bargains and deals. I mean, so he says, you know, aspiration means I have a keen interest in something, which means it never leaves my mind. It never leaves my mind. I mean, it doesn't mean we don't have families and relationships and work. It's not like we're always, you know, recalling Dharma teachings and going over Dharma talks while life is. But the practices of Dharma, which we know will bring us healing and transformation, we're remembering them as we go through our day, as we deal with life and situations, as we deal with our stuff. You know, we hear the voice of our aspiration, and that voice needs to be strong. And there are ways to do it, and we'll get into that. you know, self-confidence, steadfastness. And he defines it as, we do not go back on what we have begun. Interesting. That's how we build confidence. And I thought about that with the, with the running back who's going, they just always go forward, don't they? They don't go back. No matter what the obstacles, they always try to keep moving that ball forward. You know, and many of us, we don't have that steadfastness. And Shanti Davis says, actually, later on, he says, before you begin this path, take an assessment. Take an assessment of your aspiration and take an assessment of where you are, where your abilities are, get very clear how much energy you want to devote to this. He says, assess that first. And then that's where you begin from. That's where you practice on. But don't fall back. He says, if you set that for yourself, every time you fall back, you are undermining your capacity to become confident in your ability. And confidence is very important. And it's not a confidence of arrogance or pride. It's a confidence of knowing that I have the capacity to accomplish what I set out to accomplish. That's confidence. And so it's very important that we, are very clear about, where we are, who we are, and where we are now and what we can accomplish. And then we commit ourselves to it. And we're steadfast. And we know that in other aspects of our life, that's the only way to succeed, right? Professionally, hobby, sport. I mean, there has to be that steadfastness, that consistency, if we want to really develop and benefit ourselves. The third is relinquishment. We have to be willing to let go of things that need to be let go of. We have to be able to stop, whether it's a mind state, whether it's a pattern of thought, whether it's a way we're speaking, whether it's an action of our body, whether it's a situation we're in. When we realize this is not wholesome, this is not supportive of my aspiration, we have to have the capacity to let it go, to relinquish it, right? Because we're very clear, again, if we don't have that power, if we just keep going down these old paths, and when we somehow wake up in them and realize, we are following a path of unwholesomeness, or we're following a path that's not taking us, or we're being idle, can we at that moment relinquish it, just let it go and get back on the path? And the fourth, which is so important, is joy. That is his fourth power: aspiration, self-confidence, steadfastness, joy, happiness. That is a very powerful energy, right? We know behaviorally, people move toward, people move toward things that make them happy. People move away from things that make them unhappy, right? Pleasure and pain. Reward and aversion. I mean, those are the polarities. So we need to take joy in the path. And so going on. So just coming back to aspiration, he says, and actually this is not him. This is, I'm reading from the Nectar of Manjusri speech by Kunzang Peldon. It's a 19th century commentary on Shantideva text, and it's line by line. He says, the root of aspiration or keen interest in the Dharma is a constant reflection and confident meditation on the fully ripened effects of positive and negative actions. Knowing that these same effects are indelible and must be experienced either as happiness or misery. So this is very important. You go, well, all right, well, how do you have some joy or enthusiasm, positive enthusiasm, for your walking the path? And he says, we need to reflect. What do we reflect on? That the causes I'm making now are going to ripen and bring me to where I want to get to. When I reflect like that, that makes me happy. You see, we need to reflect on the positives of what we're doing, the positives that we are reaping and will reap even in the future. And the key thing, as again, this very much goes back to the retreat where we focused on that Americans, we skip reflection. We go, we hear the teachings, then we try to practice. We read the teachings, then we practice. But the Buddha said, and all the teachers said, and here they're saying again, reflect. How often do we reflect deeply, daily, on why I'm practicing? How often do I reflect on, the pain and the suffering of my life that I want to no longer experience? I mean, to know that I'm leaving suffering behind makes me happy. Right? Right? You know? If I've been in jail, suffering, unhappy, and all of a sudden they open the door and I can go out, you know, when I step out, I'm going to be happy. I don't even know where I'm going. Right? But just to know that I am now on a path that I can have control of my life, right? You know, in that moment, that prisoner is happy. Because they know there's a way out of suffering. And so we have to reflect on why we practice. How often do we need to reflect? As often as we need to remind ourselves where we've been, what our life was like, and if we didn't have a practice, a way of healing and transforming, what our life would be like. But also, what are the rewards? You know, this is why we read the teachings. These are why we hopefully have elders in the Sangha and elders in the community and great teachers in the world and mentors, people who can attest, you know, that it does get better. That makes me happy to know that I'm on a path that'll bring me to where I want to get to. There's happiness in that, right? And to remember that, you know, oh, I'm on a path that I can really bring benefit to beings. I can not only bring benefit to myself, but I can help my family members. I can bring them greater joy and happiness and ease. I can help people learning a new way of living. But you see, we don't think about that during the day, do we? We don't reflect on that. And so therefore we forget it. And we get caught up in other kinds of historical energies within ourselves. This is in terms of, he calls it courageous self-confidence. He says, first, we must decide that we ourselves will accomplish the task. Second, we must tell ourselves that we will not succumb to defiled emotions. Third, we must assure ourselves that we are able to do it, reflecting that we are indeed able to discard all faults and accomplish every excellent quality. And he says, and we often do this when we're already engaged in the task and have started to flag and become weary of it. So again, how does one, you know, people, this is very important because people who don't have confidence in themselves, confidence in the path, who kind of have a mindset that is more self-defeating, self-critical, not very supportive of themselves, not very supportive of their aspiration and their capacities. He says, we need to reflect like this when those mind states are occurring, when we're starting to flag, you know, become weary, right? This reflection, can I accomplish this task? You know, if I really don't believe I can accomplish a task, I'm always going to be doubting it. I'm always going to be pulling back. So, you know, this is what he said, you know, this is why, again, can I, you know, to really believe I can accomplish this? Now, how do you know you can accomplish it? You might say, I don't know. This fears or these anxieties or this, you know, this kind of down mind, this irritation, anger, this judgmental mind, you know, it's always been with me. It's not going to change. But I would ask you, have you never changed anything about yourself? You know, do you really not have any patterns, some deeply ingrained, that you haven't freed yourself of? Or you know, considerably lessened its hold on you? And you'd have to say, no, I've done that. I've changed. You know, I'm not who I was 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 3 years ago or even 1 year ago. Well, if you can change one thing, you can change everything. That's just logical. You can't change everything at once, but you can change one thing at a time, and over time, you'll have changed everything. I mean, isn't that true? Plus, we look around and we see other human beings, our Sangha brothers and sisters who are close, you know, the elders in our community, who will often say to the newer ones, yeah, I used to be like that. I used to have the same exact thing. I still do. I still hear it sometimes. But it's so much less. It's so much less now. Or I don't even go down that road anymore. That should give us confidence that we can do this. Second, we must tell ourselves that we will not succumb to defiled emotion. Succumb is the key. You know, this is very important. A lot of people get discouraged because their defiled mind states and afflictions still arise. Of course they arise. The mind is conditioned. It is conditioned by our past. And if we have cultivated these mind states in the past, they will arise again. They cannot not but arise. Succumb to them means when they arise, what do we do? That's succumbing, giving in. And that's where practice comes in. People go, oh, I can't believe I've been practicing all these years and these things still arise. Well, of course they arise. They arise because we cultivated these mind states for decades. That's not the problem. The problem is when they arise, we succumb to them. What does succumb mean? Which means we end up letting them take us over. And again, fortunately in our path, we have practices which enable us to be present to what's arising, to see it, to name it, to label it, to look deeply into it, and to transform it. We don't repress it. We don't deny it. But we don't succumb to it. Because succumb to it keeps us in the same place we've always been. And we assure ourselves that we are able to do it. Everyone is able to do it. How can I say that? Because all mind states are conditioned. Whatever your mind state, whatever your issue, you weren't born with it. You didn't come out of the womb, you know, with issues. They were developed later on. And anything that can be developed can be undeveloped. As well as once we become conscious, we can consciously go about wanting to develop wholesomeness, wholesome mind states, patience, love, and acceptance and understanding, generosity. You know, there's so many things that we can be cultivating that transform and heal us. And now I'm reading about the force of joy. This is really sweet. He says, small children delight in their games. Because, you know, sometimes Dharma seems very kind of heavy, especially Shantideva. He's I call him an Old Testament Buddhist. I mean, he's heavy duty. You know, it's another era of Dharma. But yet, and every now and then he throws in words like, you know, lightness or joy or happiness, which shows really where he's at. So he says, small children delight in their games, and they do not expect any reward for what they do, whether now or in their life to come. They want only the simple joy of play, and they never have enough of it. This is exactly how bodhisattvas should be in whatever they do for the sake of others. Acts of generosity, any other of the paramitas. They ought not to expect any reward for what they do. Instead, they should simply be devoted to the task that they're doing. Just take great pleasure and exhilaration from what they do, just like children, right? They love their play, don't they? Totally involved in their play. It's just play, it's not real, right? Because they're not looking for outcome. They're just in the play. And they have a wonderful ability to go from one play to another. They go to the next one, right? And they just keep, you know. And so he's not saying to be like a child, but he's saying, look at that attitude, because they're free. They're enjoying what they're doing. They're not heavy. They're not thinking about what is this, you know, dun, 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 you know, dun, dun, you know. They're not thinking of the past. They're not thinking of the future. They're just totally doing what they're doing. That's the way we should be. Bodhisattvas should be, you know, totally involved in our life, of helping, of giving, of practicing generosity, practicing patience, practicing mindfulness, practicing introspection, practicing transformation of unwholesome mind states, cultivating the wholesome. You know, it's just, we should just be doing it and enjoy doing it. And the outcome will come naturally. And then, as he said earlier, these four forces are supported by these earnest practice, the strength of earnest practice, and the practice of controlling body, speech, and mind, some degree. Yeah, unfortunately, my friends, we need some degree of self-control. Sorry to say that. Right? We need some degree of self-control over our body, speech, and mind. Without some degree of self-control, we are lost. Because we can't, no matter what our aspirations are, no matter what our goals are, no matter what our heart's telling us, if we don't have the capacity to be somewhat in control of the actions of our physical body, you know, of the words that come out of our mouth, and some degree of control over where our mind goes, then it'll be very difficult for us to implement anything that we want, right? So, you know, and that's what we're learning. You know, that's the kind of the discipline of practice, of mindfulness, that we're aware of what we're doing. We're aware of the actions of our body. You know, we're not just unconsciously, you know, letting our body and its impulsivity lead us around. We're aware of where we are. We're aware of where our body is going toward. And we have criteria, wholesome, unwholesome. We exercise some degree of self-control. We don't just let our mouth flap. many people, you know, they their mouth is just an open flap, right? I just, and anything I think just comes out of it. There's no self-awareness. There's no self-control. No, words are very, you know, words are key. They're the primary way we relate to each other. You know, and the Buddhism has a lot to say about what is right speech, what is loving speech, what is constructive speech, and what is harmful, what is destructive, what is divisive. So we need to exercise self-control, but most importantly, we need to exercise self-control over our mind. We can't just let it roam wherever we want. And that's, of course, you know, mental cultivation, mindfulness, concentration, insight, all those practices we do give us an ability of self-control. The 5 mindfulness trainings, the 14 mindfulness trainings give us control over the actions of our body and our speech. They, you know, but it's not control for the sake of control. It's control so we are able to move smoothly, effortlessly, consistently along our chosen path. You know, and again, I would encourage all of us to reflect daily, you know, what is the path that I've chosen in this life? Why have I chosen this path? Right? I mean, this is a daily meditation, you know. Why have I chosen this path? What is it? There has to be a reason for it. What do I hope to accomplish by following this path? You know, we have to take ownership. You know, we can't just be unconsciously going along, you know, saying we're doing something, but we don't have ownership. We haven't made it personal. We haven't made it intimate. We haven't really said inwardly, yeah, I, you know, like to myself. It's like a commitment that we make with ourselves. Yeah, I am committed to following this path. I am committed to the transformation of my body, speech, and mind. I'm committed to really being of benefit to others, right? And throughout my day and the actions of my body, speech, and mind, I will be doing my best to always be doing actions of body, speech, and mind that are taking me on my path, just working it, and very diligent not to go off, right? I mean, there has to be that ownership. You know, many people don't have ownership. So they're, you know, they're very... You know, many of us are very good in public, but you know, we get away from the public when we're just alone with ourselves. You know, it's like anything goes. Well, that anything goes is not anything goes, you see. The anything that goes when we do that is the anything that goes from our conditioning. Don't be surprised when you kind of just kick back, whatever that means, that what takes over is your conditioning, because that's our default. So again, the reason I wanted to share this morning these four forces, because again, they're not about the actual practices of Dharma. They're actually the forces that are needed to be able to practice Dharma and get some real benefit from. Right? Aspiration, steadfastness, confidence, relinquishment, and joy. These are the 4 forces that we need to cultivate. So good. I get a few minutes. If you have any questions, please, you can chat them in to Bill. Just at the bottom of your screen, there's a chat function and you can chat them in, but there is somebody in the hall who, right? You, Jose, you wanna? So somebody wanna give Jose a mic? Is it a short question? So again, I'll just say it out loud. So the question is what? The concept of unwholesomeness, yes.
Wholesomeness for me is, I mean, there's all these things that are wholesome and wholesome, good and bad, but is really all wholesome. And I define the color like anything that.
So let me just say, so Jose's saying, he's trying to go in his own mind, how does he define wholesome and unwholesome? Because sometimes it's not clear. And so therefore, he's now sharing the process he goes through, which is what? Okay. So, but see, that's important. So Jose says he defines unwholesome as anything that interferes with his inner peace. So again, you're defining wholesome and unwholesome in terms of your aspiration. You see, your aspiration is I want to have inner peace. I want to be more peaceful in my mind, right? Which means there's no conflict, there's no agitation, right? It's not always stirred up, not a lot of emotionality. It's peaceful, it's calm. So anything that supports that, you would consider wholesome. Anything that doesn't support it or disturbs that is unwholesome. Yeah, that's exactly right. But then but again, that's great. But then how do we live that? You see, that's our thing. And I think that's what they're getting at, is that we have to, carry that with us, carry that aspiration with us. You know, guests can't be here in the hall when we're stepping back and you're reflecting. I know you're a veterinarian, right? So again, I mean, it's like, do you carry that aspiration with you? I'm not saying you don't, you know what I mean? But you carry it with you. You know, you carry it to the office, you carry it to your interactions with others, you carry it to home and your interaction with other people. You know, is that aspiration with you? And are you watchful? See, and obviously the more stronger that aspiration is and the more watchful we are, you know what I'm saying, the more chance that you will experience a peaceful mind. Is that right? And if we don't do that, then then we won't experience that. Right? Yeah. Thank you, Jose. Yes, Bill.
Could you speak more about the force of relinquishment?
Yeah, so this is very powerful. In some translations, relinquishment is sort of translated by as like disgust relinquishment. Which is interesting. When I first read it, I said, wow, that's pretty strong. You see, to relinquish means what? To let go, right? We let go of something. And if we let go of something, let's say something unwholesome, just because somebody told me it's unwholesome, right? Or, that's sort of like a religious way of doing it. You see, where, I've been told this is bad and therefore I should relinquish it. But Buddhism says, no, we should look deeply. We should reflect deeply. And so we should look at these habits, right? These habits of action, the things we do with our body, the things we put into it, the things we do with it. Look at these patterns of speech that we indulge ourselves in. And look at our mind and the mind states we indulge ourselves in and ask ourselves, this is again that reflection piece. We should reflect on each of these mind states, each of these hindrances, each of these places and goes and think, is this good for me? Is this healthy for me? Is this creating positive energy in my life or negative energy in my life? You see? And what that word disgust means like I come to the conclusion, no, this is not good. Right? This is not good for me. It's not healthy for me. Or this is not good or healthy, for me to bring this into my relations with other people. You see, so if there's not that, disgust is a strong word, but you know what I mean. It's sort of like you just go, ooh, this is disgusting. It's not good. It's not pretty. It's not beautiful. It's not wholesome. And so when there is that disgust quality that comes from reflection, we have to look at our egocentricity. We have to look at our judgmental mind. We have to look at our negative mind. We have to look at the mind of dissatisfaction. We have to look at these things. And be disgusted by it, going, yeah, this is not good. it doesn't feel good when I'm here. It doesn't help my relationships. It harms my path. You see, then letting go, relinquishing, becomes much easier. But if we haven't gone through that process, if we just kind of have, I don't want to do this. And we wonder, why am I still doing this years later? It's because we haven't daily reflected on this habit within myself and come to the place where it disgusts us. I mean, it doesn't, like, for those people who go down the road of shame and self-hate, this is not that, okay? You're not disgusted with yourself. You're disgusted with this, the energy of this mind state. Is that clear? That's what you're disgusted with. It's not about you. You're good. You know, you want to be wholesome. You want to be happy. That's who you are. But there's this part of us, this old part of us, that still operates quite robotically on these old ways, these old patterns, these old cuds that it chews on. You know, and there has to be that weariness. Maybe weariness is a better word than disgust. We have to be weary of it. So there's some energy to, when it arises, that we let go, we relinquish, and we do something else. Maybe, is there one more, Bill, or we should?
An observation is, if you're tired after a day of work, it can be hard to maintain discipline and steadfastness.
Well, again, I'm not suggesting, you know, I understand, you know, I understand. I used to work a job. Actually, I still work, come to think of it. So I understand what he or she is sharing. Again, yeah, at the end of a day, maybe we are physically tired, or maybe some of us, because so many people do kind of mental work these days, you know, their minds are tired. But the question is, what can we do in the evening that nourishes us? You see, it's not just like you come home and, you know, you break out the Dharma books, right? It's not like you come home and immediately cross your legs and sit down to meditate for 3 hours, which is nothing wrong with that. But it means you look at how we spend our time. Again, idleness means it's just entertainment. Now, again, you know, a little entertainment, yeah, that's nothing wrong with that. But we have to look at hours of entertainment, hours of idleness. Is that clear? That's what we're talking about. And could I be using that way? And again, to nourish myself. I mean, this may sound strange, you know. You know, preparing your dinner in a mindful way can be very nourishing. You can be, you know, you can be, the mind quiets down, you're very present, you know, you're creating something that is good and wholesome for you, perhaps others. You know, eating the food with appreciation, you know, taking the time before eating to share appreciation, you know, for the food and the ones who prepared the food and picked the food, you know. Enjoy washing the dishes and cleaning up the kitchen. I mean, you know, there is the way to go about life, even our daily tasks, that is nourishing and enjoyable. You know, go for walks in the evening, especially now that it's cooler. You know, and enjoy fresh air and the body moving and, you know, quiet. I mean, I don't do it, but I know people who go to gyms and everything. They're very noisy places, aren't they? A lot of blasting music and stuff. You know, they're not, you know, they're not nourishing. You know, go for walks. Sit outside on your deck, or, you know, just relax. If you're going to read things that nourish you. If you're going to listen to music that nourishes you, makes you happy. So there's, like, you know, there's lots of ways that we can nourish our mind, our healthy minds. Okay? So thank you all. And our retreat is continuing on, so I have to meet with our group soon. So thank you all. I hope this was helpful today.